What's your statute of limitations on food found on your desk?
Are we talking 5-second rule, 1-minute rule, 1-day rule?
Let's say theoretically I had some fruit gummies, Welch's yesterday, not a product placement, delicious fruit flavored gummies.
Okay. Non-narcotic, I assume.
No, they were not weed gummies. They were the ones that I put in my daughter's lunch sometimes when I want to give her a treat. And possibly when I cleaned off my desk at the end of the day yesterday, there was an extra one left in the bag that I noticed as I sat down here this morning. It's like, I like a fruit gummy. So 24 hours, is that in the, like, it's dry. It doesn't go bad.
Feels like a real Homer Simpson-esque situation, like pondering found food, the edibility thereof.
It's still squishy.
I take that back. Like, Homer wouldn't hesitate, right? Like, you have more class than Homer Simpson because you're at least thinking about it.
In what is possibly on rewatch, the most offensive Simpsons episode ever, the Venus de Milo, Gummy de Milo one, where he grabs the gummy off of the babysitter's ass as she's getting out of the car and then starts a sexual harassment thing. Yes. And they minimize the idea that sexual harassment is a real thing throughout the entire episode. Yes, he did not hesitate. He saw the gummy and ate it without a second thought. It's red also, if that makes a difference. It's not one of the oranges, which is an okay flavor. It's not a green, which is a bad flavor.
It's top tier, upper echelon.
It's like, it's easily a top 10% flavor for the Welch's fruit gummies.
Well, you've also mentioned, you say the desk is dust free.
I got a blower. I got a fan that blows canned air and I plug it into the wall.
Oh, what brand did you get?
I got whatever one was $35 on Amazon.
Also not product placement.
Yeah.
I think mine is an X Power. Sound of chair creaking. Okay, that's not the one I have.
Mine is a Sunshine.
Okay.
Like, it looks like sunshine. It has a logo that looks like sun.
Wait a minute. But it's, so yeah. That's how you clean your desk? You're not dusting. You're just moving the dust around.
There's an air filter. So I put the dust in the air and then the air filter takes it out. It's like I'm cutting out the middleman. How do you dust?
With a duster?
Like, do you put on your French maid outfit and get the feathers out at the same time?
Look, I have a whole process. Okay.
Oh boy, that sounds like another episode. Okay. So yeah, I think I'm going to eat the gummy after the episode. It's my reward for a podcast well done.
Wait a minute. What? Come on. If you're going to eat the gummy, you need to do it on the spot.
I'm drinking coffee too.
That's so?
It's going to make it both things taste bad. Everything's going to be worse because of the gummy.
Man.
Okay, here we go. A little less chewy than normal. A little denser.
Okay.
Getting some good chewing sounds in here for y'all.
Oh, yes. ASMR, new category we're trying to expand
into. Strong flavor. Maybe a little bit of a dust coating on the outside, if I'm being honest.
Okay. A little mealy or something.
Probably my immune system is probably getting even more boosted than it already was. I'd say it's a 9 out of 10 Welch's fruit gummy experience.
Well, then let this be a lesson to you all. To observe all gummy containment protocols.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
Brad, I'm bivalent now.
Bivalent?
I'm bivalent.
Hang on, I feel like, don't tell me I should know what that means. Well, I typed bivalent into Google and it immediately suggested a bivalent booster as search.
So this is, I've now had two normal shots and two boosters, one of which was bivalent. I'm ready. I'm strong.
Uh-huh.
My arm hurts.
Just to be clear, you're talking about the Omicron booster.
Yeah, I got the Omicron booster yesterday.
How's your reception?
Look, I'd say I'm 5.5, maybe 6 Gs right now.
Okay, because you got the antenna upgrade installed, right?
Yeah, I mean, nobody's turned on the microwave oven yet, so I don't know how that's going to work. Okay. I don't feel as strong as I was hoping right out the gate, but I think it's a 2-week incubation period as usual. You know, it's got to get its tendrils into your brain.
The subliminal directives from Lord Gates are coming in loud and clear.
I haven't heard anything from Lord Gates yet, more than the normal background hum of, you know, kill all apples.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I got the booster yesterday. We went to the Mission this time.
Oh,
because they had the Moderna one, and I'm three Pfizers to this point. So I want the
three Pfizers to the wind.
Yeah. Well, the general recommendation is you kind of want to mix and match for maximum strength on the thing.
Yes.
So nobody had Moderna here. So except for this one place in the Mission.
Interesting.
So I had to schlep down to the Mission and park and like walk and like. Also, I could have gotten some Narcan if I wanted there. So it was convenient. Ooh, that's
always nice to have around
just in case.
Yeah, I had planned to get Moderna. Mm-hmm. I am one of the relatively few Johnson & Johnson getters.
Well, what did you get your booster for, though?
So I got the Moderna booster, the first one. They were strongly, for whatever reason, they were strongly recommending Johnson & Johnson people get Moderna for the first booster because they were seeing, for whatever reason, better efficacy with those two combined rather than Pfizer. But now that I've had two, should I just complete the set and go get a Pfizer?
Look, if you go to Canada, you could get an AstraZeneca. You get a novel vaccine.
Mm. Is that one mRNA or no?
I don't know. I can't remember at this point. I would do five. I mean, I don't know. I would read what the doctors say and do what they say, but it seems like everybody says get a variety and you're better off.
Was it hard to get? Like I went into this. First of all, I feel like the very approval just sort of came out of nowhere or snuck up on us. Like there was not a big fanfare in the news when the FDA pushed it through, which confirms or reinforces my suspicion that like maybe people aren't actually jumping out of their chairs to go get this because most people seem to just not care about COVID anymore.
It wasn't. So the mass vaccination sites are gone. It seems like so like the San Mateo County Fair Center, the one that was out at the Catholic Reardon Hospital Reardon in San Francisco. Those are all gone. It seems like COVID's over. So, you know,
sure.
I mean, look, don't pay attention to the 500, 600 people dying every day. It's not a real, they're not real. It's just that's just a figment. Everything's good. Go back to your normal ways of life. We used the myturn.gov site or .ca.gov, whatever. And it found Gina was able to find a place that had the one we wanted relatively easily.
Yeah, the reason I ask is mainly just like, you know, if you'd asked me 3-4 months ago, like, hey, what's the rush going to be like when the new booster, the variant booster comes along? Like, I would have assumed it was going to be like lines out the door of people trying to get that thing. But I'm guessing at this point, it's like you could practically just walk in.
Well, so the pharmacy we went to had like a steady stream of people in and out getting COVID vaccines.
Okay.
And they had like, but it wasn't like there were 50 people there doing extra COVID vaccines. It was like they had a table in the front to register the COVID vaccine people. And also the monkeypox vaccine people. And I think also the polio vaccine people, but I'm not sure about that. So yeah, it was, I don't know. It was fine.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. My arm hurts. It's so far, it hasn't been any worse than the other one. When my daughter got her Pfizer kid booster, which is not the bivalent one the other day, the second one kind of knocked her out. Like she was a little wrecked as a result, but also having recently had COVID, I don't want to have it again. It sucks to be avoided. So get your boosters.
That. Yeah. Did you get your flu shot at the same time or could you get your flu? Do they allow that?
Well, you can, but they weren't offering it there at the same time. So Gina stopped on the way home to get her flu shot. I'm going to do mine later today or tomorrow because it tends to hit me pretty hard. And I had stuff I had to get done today.
Okay.
Including recording this podcast.
Yes, indeed. So it seems like maybe that would be more efficient's not the right word, but maybe more convenient to just stack both of them. And then if you're going to have side effects, like get it all over with at once.
So Gina fell asleep on the couch about 7:30 last night.
Okay.
And like the kiddo and I came in and we watched a movie. Like it was loud. The dog climbed up on her. Uh-huh. At one point I looked over to make sure she was still breathing. Everything was fine.
Wait, dog?
Oh, we're dog sitting.
Some
friends. Yeah.
Okay.
We haven't gotten a dog.
All right.
But I will say, The condition on getting a dog in our house is that the kid has to help with the dog watching.
Aha.
And she is like, I walked out this morning after we were getting ready to start recording and she was feeding the dog. Mm-hmm. She's taken the dog out already today.
Wow.
Like it is, we've turned a corner on dog maintenance for children at this point.
You're saying there's some possible dog desire around the house?
I'd say there's probably a dog in our not too distant future.
Okay.
But you know, what's dogging people this week?
Speaking of canines,
it's scene drama.
Is it?
Is it scene drama?
This is, dude, I think this like vastly
You think surpasses this is bigger than
okay. scene drama? This is like corporation drama, corporate
okay.
drama.
Okay, okay. I mean, like,
this is the weirdest. This might be the weirdest corporate situation I have ever seen.
Well, so it's weird on two fronts because it's a really unusual story. And also the way it has been reported and presented and put out to the press is real weird. Absolutely yes. bonkers. Yes. I would say
we should probably say what it is we're talking about.
Oh yeah. So NVIDIA EVGA is what was once upon a time the kind of most favored nation of NVIDIA GPU providers will no longer be selling NVIDIA GPUs after the 3000 series cards run their course.
Yes. And like that's wild on its face. The way that this was revealed is also wild separately. Like there's a lot here. But first of all, I was going to say, I'm glad to hear you say that most favored nation bit about them, because like having not worked in the tech press, I didn't know that like factually. But like I've always in a gut sense felt like they were probably the most prominent or most well-liked.
So yeah, they started in 1999. Our assumption my assumption as somebody who used to review video cards for a living and talking to other people was that I don't believe they've ever actually said this, but my assumption was that like the review cards and the reference boards that were provided were assembled by EVGA for a long time.
Okay. Before we move on,
just to be clear, speculation okay. that is informed by information, but never confirmed.
Okay. Should I ask what evidence
the board was, designs were the same and the markings okay. on the boards and stuff like that. Yeah, like nothing. Yeah. It's just something you know, when you're at press events for games and people are talking about like what game's coming and what games they just played and stuff like, this is the kind of shit that video card reviewers talk about at events.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Got it. This is like, you know, you have some unique perspective having worked for so long in that space longer, certainly than a lot of people who are doing it now, but like,
maybe not.
Not all of them.
Yeah.
I was pretty excited to see Gordon pop up on Gamers Nexus a couple weeks ago. It's like, all right, all you Johnny come lately. It's like,
yeah, young whippersnappers.
Yes, here comes the godfather of hardware reviews. I guess I was going to ask like what the old review process was like, or like what were those cards like? Like I was adjacent enough to people that reviewed hardware that I would occasionally like see an NVIDIA reference board, but like,
so we were magazines, so we always got stuff real early, probably before anything was close to being ready to actually show. Often it would be that I would load up a test machine in the car, drive down to NVIDIA's headquarters, and they'd set me up in a conference room for 2 or 3 days.
Oh, wow.
And I would just plug in their reference board into my machine to run benchmarks on it.
Oh, that's wild. I figured they were at least just sending them out.
So often they would send it out. It depends on how, like, it really depended on how, honestly, probably depended on how they were doing compared to what AMD was doing in the market. Because if they were sales leading, then they wouldn't do that because they didn't want to cannibalize their sales until the very last possible minute, wouldn't announce anything too early. If they were not sales leading, then they would announce something super early and torch whatever AMD was selling well.
Right.
So having
to go to them with your own computer that's almost the Nintendo padlocking a metal frame around with a GameCube level of protecting your product.
Well, no. Us taking our own computer was a condition of us doing the.
No. I know that part. Yeah, that's tangential. What I meant was the having to go to them and do all the stuff there and then leave the card there.
Yeah. I mean, so we had sometimes when it wasn't a review, like for the Dream Machine 1 year, we had a really early programmable shader ATI card. And they brought the machine, they brought the card to us. So they brought two cards. They brought one that was a non-functional dummy card for photography.
Huh.
Cause like we would need it over 5 days for different photos and they didn't want to have somebody stand there holding it. And then on benchmark day, they brought a functional card that we plugged in. And prior to the benchmark day, I went over to their offices and did some tests to see if it was going to like be as fast as they claimed it was in our terms. But yeah, so often it was like driving down there. Sometimes we get the board really early. Sometimes we'd get a brief and then the board would come in with like 48 hours before press. Cause they'd always want to hold until the last possible minute to get drivers or whatever. And often, especially in the magazine days, they would say, hey, here are benchmarks that we know are not going to perform as we would expect because they just haven't gotten to them on the driver optimization loop yet. And that was kind of to be expected.
Yeah.
So yeah, but the Founders Edition cards were usually unmarked, or they'd have just a plain NVIDIA logo on like the cooler
reference board.
Reference board. Sorry, they were usually like plain unsilk screened coolers. This was before the cards were completely encased in metal, right? So it was like a all in one fan heatsink cooler jammed onto the board, and those would be like, you know, they'd be like a quarter of the board, and you'd see the rest of the board, and you look at the markings and pop the cooler off real easy if you wanted and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I saw a few NVIDIA reference cards around GameSpot back in that era.
Yeah, sometimes if you were getting access to something really really early, it might still have like jumpers and stuff on it where they could do debug input and output.
Interesting.
Or not jumpers, dip switches. Oh, but that would have been in like the early 2000s, late 90s, before the modern GPU era started.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. So like, I mean, EVGA has always seemed like maybe if not the go-to brand for GPUs, like it's absolutely up there. I mean, also is the Step Up program as kind of like legendary as I think it is, or I've never.
People really like it. I always thought it was a little bit questionable of a financial value just because the product cycles are not annual and are hard to tell when things are going to go. I know people who've used it and have had good luck. It was novel. If you don't know what the Step Up program is, basically the idea is like you can buy a GPU before, like toward the end of a life cycle, you buy a GPU and you pay a little bit into the Step Up program extra. And then you can turn that GPU back in and get the next one for not as much money as the whole thing would cost. So you're basically buying like 1.5 GPUs and getting two, but you have to send one back, kind of.
Yeah. It's basically just like a way to guarantee like, okay, if they launch the next generation card next month.
Yeah.
You can swap this one for that one.
Yeah. And it was kind of like, look, it's an opportunity for them to. Okay, so there's some things we have to explain about the add-in board market. What EVGA and what MSI and ASUS and all the companies that make, Gigabyte make aftermarket GPUs that aren't the NVIDIA branded Founders Edition ones are their add-in board vendors is what they're called. And they're typically like companies that have production lines in Taiwan where they have pick and place machines and soldering machines and all that kind of stuff. And they design boards, sometimes less so these days, I feel like. They design custom coolers often, and then they'll sell those boards at a little bit of a premium over the kind of base level board. In the old days, they would add like more memory, or they'd overclock the memory, or they'd overclock the. I mean, they still overclock the CPUs and GPUs some, but the impact of that is negligible these days, it seems like. It's traditionally been, it's one of those markets that like the volume is probably pretty good. They probably sell quite a few cards. But the margins are incredibly thin. It's like, it's the kind of place where like the difference between a 3 cent capacitor and a 4 cent capacitor is like something that they really think about. Right. So they're also completely at the mercy of the partner. Right. So like their 3000 series car, they order 3000 series GPUs from NVIDIA. They are expected to fulfill that order, even if NVIDIA decides they're going to release 4000 series cards. Right. And the prices are probably fixed based on the deals. My assumption, I don't know how nobody really knows how those deals are structured, because most of these companies are either private or the division that does this is small enough. It doesn't get rolled up into annual reporting. So, NVIDIA, EVGA launched in 99. They almost immediately became like the ones that were first out the gate with the reference design. So, okay, here's the other thing that's important. Those boards that NVIDIA sent to press and partners and stuff like that, that had like us, they all have the same cooler. They all have the same board design. That's what's called a reference design. And so the first 6 months or a year of cards that come out after they announce a new GPU will all have the same board design. And most of them will have the same or some variation of the same cooler. Those are designed by NVIDIA. Now, after that initial period, once the add-in board vendors have had time with the boards and their engineers can like redesign boards and replay stuff and, you know, move stuff around for better cooling or whatever, you get like the souped up cards that use different board designs. You'll start seeing water blocks and hybrid coolers that use a water block and a fan. You'll see like the MSI, famously the MSI makes the Frozer coolers that are like these big 3-slot monstrosities that stick out the top. They're totally outside the PCI Express spec. But they'll like, you know, they'll cool your thing like 8% better or something. And they have like cool lights on them.
Hang on. I'm sorry. I have to point out here in the notes, you spelled Frozer with an E.
It's called Frozer.
That is not on brand.
Oh, is it F-R-O-Z-O-R?
No, I think it's no vowel. Let me hang on.
No. It's F-R-O-Z-E-R, I'm pretty sure.
Nope. No vowel. F-R-O-Z-R.
Wow. I apologize.
The lack of a vowel makes it 10 times stupider.
Man, maybe it has always been no R. Okay, anyway, that's not the point. The point is, like, that stuff. So, okay, and to give you a sense of scale, NVIDIA spends billions of dollars developing new GPUs, coolers, reference boards, right? That and board vendors spend probably millions of dollars, not more than tens of millions on each board design and each cooler design. And then they get that money back by selling the fancy souped up cards at a pretty high markup over the stock cards.
Yeah. Before we move forward more, I remember back in the day, like the kind of like the souped up cards, like you said, were a pretty big deal, or they seemed like decent volume movers. That was a lot of like, hey, this GPU is running at 10% higher clock and stuff like that. Like, I know on the memory side, there are more limitations now because more of it is integrated with the GPU, but are those overclocks not still like a big kind of front of box selling point anymore?
Well, so once the memory controllers went into the GPU and stopped being an external thing, then the ability to dink with the memory configurations went way down, right? So they have to do stuff that's built in and supported by the card, by the GPU rather than the card.
So fewer just to, because this, I think this will be relevant later. Like, so fewer variations in the AIB cards than there used to be in terms of like
fewer
performance.
Fewer dials for those people to turn. Right.
Okay.
The other thing is the boards have become way more complex. Like if you look at NVIDIA's 3000 series cards where they have the cutout on the backside and they're like these complicated multi-layer boards, those are more expensive to produce. So the margins are going to get thinner for the AIB vendors. The other thing is the coolers that NVIDIA produces have gotten dramatically better. Like you remember the 5000 series NVIDIA cards that came out, and like they made like NVIDIA's marketing group made a video mocking how loud they were. This sounds like a Harley Davidson. I think it sounds really cool. Like a leaf blower.
You know, I respect it.
Yeah.
Like when you've got a product like that on your hands, you might as well just lean into it in the most ridiculous way.
Look, that video, just to be clear, is on the list with like Adam Boy's showing how you share a game,
a PS4
on the PlayStation,
game.
Yes. A PS4 game
by handing it to Shuhei Yoshida.
Yeah, exactly. Like those are like baller moves from like conference room videos. Okay,
just to be clear, that was the GeForce FX, correct?
GeForce FX 5000, 5800, I think. But even like the 5900, which was supposedly quieter, was still sounded like a damn jet turbine in your computer when it spun up. So
I have to find that video. We'll move on, but I have to find that video.
It's pretty funny. But the point is NVIDIA has started paying a lot more attention to thermals and noise and things like that. And as a result, their coolers have gotten over the last, especially like three or four generations, their coolers have gotten really good. So there's less like, so that means in turn, there's less market for, hey, we're selling a really quiet version of this super fast video card, or we're selling a really overclocked loud version because you don't give a shit and you just want it to be 15% faster version. Because the reference designs are good to very good. So from the vendor's perspective, they have less options to less dials that they can turn to make a fancy souped up product to sell at a high margin. Cause like the water cooling stuff is good, but ultimately the water cooling units aren't going to sell massive volume. Like the ones that sell massive volume are the Frozers, right? The ones that is like, hey, here's three big stupid fans and it has some lights on it. And that's going to look good when you're standing in the store at Best Buy. The other thing is most of that component sales has gone from retail where you're standing there looking at numbers on a box to going to PC Part Picker and picking the one that everybody recommends. And then that's the one that you buy at the price that you get, because they're all kind of the same. From NVIDIA's perspective, I think, and they've never said this, obviously, but my guess is that they look at the AIB partners and they're like, look, man, we spend billions of dollars making these things fast and reliable and quiet and good. And then the chucklehead overclockers come in and they turn some dials and put on 10% better capacitors. And they say that our thing is shit, and they build boards that are less reliable and cause support issues for us. So
are they less reliable?
Probably not. I mean, okay, probably not on a one-by-one cases, but like over the run, the overclocked boards are probably going to have problems compared to the stock clock boards. Yeah,
that's fair. Can I ask you, let me jump in real fast. I mean, I'm not trying to throw shade at any companies or more to the point, ask you to throw shade. But like, is there a kind of second or third tier of AIB manufacturer that is like less trusted or like considered to be lower quality below the ASUSs, the EVGAs? Like, I hesitate to say this, I don't know why this comes to mind, but like Zotac, for example, is a name that I'm not familiar with them at all. They may be just as good as all the others, but like occasionally you would see cards for a given generation coming from companies you kind of never heard of before. And or are they all basically the same? Like, am I reading too much into like the kind of relative notoriety of each company?
I think you're probably, I honestly don't know. Like, I haven't reviewed third party cards in a really long time.
Okay.
And in order to like the problems that come with that, with like, it's kind of like the old, like leaking capacitors on Enforce chipsets, right? When you just do a review and you run benchmarks for 10 hours and you play games with it for another 10 hours, you're probably not going to see the problem if there is one. So I'm not in a position to say one way or the other.
To be clear, like I think a lot of that question is holdover from like the 3DFX days when like there were voodoos coming from every which way.
Yeah.
Like there were like two dozen different companies putting voodoo cards on the market and half of them you'd never heard of.
I feel like generally speaking, we're better at building hardware these days than we were 20 years ago.
Yes. That
is fair. And like the failure rates of the things that cause components to fail are better understood, so that then the problems come when you have like a problem with silicon doping and capacitors or something goofy, right? Like some seemingly inconsequential impurity in the thing that goes into the part that then causes a manufacturing defect later. And that stuff should be covered by warranty, right? If there's a manufacturing defect in the card, the warranty should pick it up.
Yes. Okay. We should talk about the actual current events topic at hand.
Yeah. So EVGA invited Gamers Nexus. Is it Jay-Z 2 cents or Jay's 2 cents?
I think it's Jay's 2 cents.
Jay's 2 cents. I don't watch that channel very much, so I don't know. This is
really have our finger on the pulse here.
Yeah, I'm high. The olds are speaking. And John Petty. John Petty is an analyst. He's carved out the stake in the analyst community as the GPU and graphical computing guy, and has been doing it for a very long time. I've known John for a long time. They invited them to come down to their headquarters in the US and talk to the CEO of EVGA, Andrew Han.
Yeah, was it the US? Or I thought they said they went to Taiwan.
Oh, maybe they went to Taiwan. I don't know. It looked like US offices to me, but who knows? Like City of Industry, Taiwan. Office parks all look the same.
Yeah.
So,
but an official visit, like straight up speaking to the CEO about the situation.
Yeah. And the TLDR is they're going to keep selling 3000 series cards until they're gone, which will likely be the end of this year. They're not going to be selling NVIDIA 4000 series cards. They'll keep enough 3000 series cards on to fulfill warranty claims, et cetera, all that kind of stuff. They notified NVIDIA in April, but only senior management knew until last week or this week. Last week for you all.
Gamers Nexus video emphasized multiple times that most of the employees at EVGA were just finding out about this the day that all these stories ran.
Yeah. And they basically announced it with the Petty's blog post, the two videos on YouTube, and a forum post, which is bananas. Han claims that they're not interested in producing add-in boards for AMD or Intel's new GPUs.
Yeah, like not to just, you know, cut straight to the chase here, but that this is the part of this that blows my mind. Like, obviously there sound like there's some combination personal and business reasons for flushing the NVIDIA relationship, but like to not replace it with what seems like could be a pretty healthy business working with competitors, like to just like, Have we talked about the revenue split here? Like GPUs are like 80% of EVGA's gross revenue.
Well, okay. And so like gross revenue is the important thing there. Because the margins on the GPU business are probably really, really small.
Yes, that is definitely true to if you're to believe all of these reports.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, I would say that is widely reported enough over the last 20 years to comfortably put that in the realm of fact, right?
Like, yeah. Also the Gamers Nexus, their breakdown that came straight from EVGA was like 78% GPUs, like about 20% power supplies, and then 2% for everything else they make, which is like, I don't know, RGB.
Keyboards, mice, water coolers, stuff like that. Cases.
Motherboards. Yeah.
Yeah. And they do, they do a custom PC business too.
Yes. And I think I want to say he said that the profit margins on power supplies are like three times what they are on the GPUs.
I can see that. It makes sense. Cause here's the thing. The problem with the GPU business is always that they're at the mercy of the partner, right? So they don't know when new products are coming. They don't know what the price is going to be on the new products. They don't know what they have to, what their infrastructure cost for the assembly line is going to be for the new hardware, right? Until NVIDIA decides to tell them. No, okay. It's also worth mentioning this, like NVIDIA's response to this was basically good luck.
Publicly or to them? Did they
publicly?
Oh, wow.
When somebody requested a quote, I can't remember who. And the quote was, "Hey, valued partner, we wish them the best luck going forward." Right. So this is an entirely one-sided story as reported by these two YouTube channels and John Petty. Everything else that came after that is based on that initial reporting. So including this. Okay. We talked about thin margins. In 2016, NVIDIA started selling Founders. So, okay, why would EVGA do this? There's a couple of reasons that I think are probably possible, and it's probably a combination of the three, if I had to guess, right? They said it wasn't a financial decision, but it was a personal decision about respect in the Gamers Nexus video, which they then said is because NVIDIA isn't giving them early access to the hardware. It isn't giving them information beforehand about pricing and things like that, so they can make informed business decisions going forward, which is fair. Like that's a fair criticism, I think.
The pricing one in particular is just like, I'm not quite sure how you're supposed to run a business and make speculative decisions about something as complex as building graphics cards and shipping them in volume without knowing what your costs are going to be.
Well, okay, so here's the... I mean, they tell you when it's time to order. You know what it is. It's not like they're ordering GPUs without knowing what the price is. What they're saying is we don't get early access to this, so we don't know as soon as NVIDIA does. So they're not competing on a fair ground with NVIDIA's Founder Edition cards, I think is the point.
Okay.
Which is fair.
So Steve in the Gamers Nexus video said there is some aspect of the pricing that they don't find out until it is announced on stage. I don't remember. Right. I guess that's not the volume pricing for the GPUs themselves. Maybe that's
don't know what NVIDIA's the MSRPs are going to be.
MSRP is what they're not finding out, I guess.
Yeah. So, the other thing about this that's interesting is traditionally the add-in board vendors have been where every leak has ever come from that I'm aware of. So NVIDIA not telling the add-in board vendors early what's going on, what the MSRP is going to be and all that stuff is a direct response to every time they've done that, it's ended up on the tech press almost immediately. So yeah,
that seems fair.
Yeah. Pros and cons. Apple had a similar situation where the case manufacturers don't know what the iPhones look like anymore in advance because they were all leaky sibs too. So
fair.
These things happen.
Yeah.
Founders Edition came out in 2016 and NVIDIA started selling cards directly. It was a small business at first, mostly tied to the really high end parts.
I haven't followed this stuff super closely until the 30 series was the 20 series was the very first Founders Edition cards. Like that concept did not exist before then. Is that correct?
No, I think it was the 10 series.
Was there a 10 series Founders Edition?
I think it was the Titans were the founder were the equivalent of the first Founders Editions.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Cause they sold Titans direct to begin with.
I see.
Okay. And the reason they gave for that was that it was a complicated board to make because of the power requirements or something. I can't remember.
Am I correct in my perception that the 30 series was when the Founders Edition really became like kind of a marquee name? I was not aware of it before then.
So they did them in the 2000 series. I feel like you went typically with the Founders Edition, what happens is they're the low price at launch. And then as the new cards come out with the 2000 series is what happened. They were the low price at launch, and then the add-in board vendors started competing against each other, and then that pushed their prices down, but the Founders Edition prices stayed the same. So the cheaper cards ended up being the EVGAs and the MSIs and the Gigabytes and all that. What happened with the 3000 series is because the Ethereum boom was in full effect, prices just kept going up no matter what. So Founders Edition prices stayed more or less the same.
Also supply constraints.
And everybody else's prices were jacked up.
Right. Because remember, also, the 30 series launched 6 months into the pandemic, so they were just... across the board completely impossible to get.
Yeah. So there's I think there's multiple things that happen. I think the thing about, hey, we're not getting early enough information to make good business decisions and feel respected probably is true. Right. I think that in a world where this is a really low margin, high volume business that involves a ton of risk, that like each purchasing decision they make can sink or swim the company. I think divesting of even an 80% of your revenue business to remove that risk, probably not a bad decision, because I don't think it's going to get any less risky, right?
Yeah.
Especially if there's like increased capital, like especially if, say, the 4000 series board is like a multi-layer board, is going to require a change in tooling on their production lines or something like that, and is going to incur substantial capital cost for them. It makes sense for them to say, hey, we're going to, rather than spend this money on a thing that may or may not continue making money for us at the rate that we want, we're just going to not do it, and we're going to make parts for cars or something, because
right,
that's a higher margin, lower risk business.
Sure. That all makes sense. I mean, to me, again, I have not kept up with this market too closely until the last couple of years, but like, it seems like the X factor here is how serious is NVIDIA about making and selling its own boards, and are they looking to aggressively grow that business? And
you know, I think that they don't care.
Is that a major factor?
I think they're ambivalent.
Interesting.
I think that it's like that part of the business is small compared to data centers and embedded and all the other stuff that they're doing now.
Well, sure, but you know, a small business could be a bigger business potentially. Well, I don't know.
I'm just saying the market for aftermarket gamer GPUs isn't gamers anymore, right? It's people who are doing data center work and machine learning stuff and all that, and are buying 10 GPUs instead of one per machine.
Well, sure.
So I guess the TLDR is, it's easy for them to send a reference design board to Foxconn or somebody and have them just crank out as many boards as they can. And you know, maybe they don't need the AIBs for this stuff as much anymore.
Yeah. I guess like maybe Apple is not the best comparison, but I'm just kind of looking at like Apple controls the entirety of their end-to-end business now, from design to manufacturing to distribution. And I wonder if there's some effort to move more in that direction. I don't know.
I think every silicon manufacturer in the Valley looks at Apple's business and is like, you know, we should do that.
Fair.
Okay. So not a financial decision. They said it wasn't about the crypto crash, which is fishy to me, because presumably, okay. So if you don't pay attention to crypto stuff, two things just happened. Ethereum, which is the main currency you could mine with GPUs, just went to proof of stake, which means that instead of the people that are mining new currency, making the decisions about what happens with the blockchain, the people who hold the most Ethereum decide what happens with the blockchain.
Right. And then to step back another level, the people mining, or let me rephrase that. The process of mining new Ethereum is the incredibly computationally heavy part, right?
Yes. Yeah. And so, it uses a lot of GPU power. It like, unlike Bitcoin, which the math for Bitcoin doesn't work particularly well on GPUs, the math for Ethereum does work well on GPUs.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize Bitcoin was not mined on.
Yeah, Bitcoin uses custom ASICs that are designed for the specific algorithm.
Interesting.
So they get much higher hash rates on ASICs for Bitcoin rather than you do on running Bitcoin on a GPU.
Oh, okay. This is illuminating, because I was trying to figure out why this one currency going to a less computationally expensive model seemed to have unilaterally pulled the rug out from under everything. But knowing that that was the one currency you needed GPUs for makes a lot more sense.
Well, and then the other thing is, for a long time, as Ethereum's price was going up and the price of GPUs was relatively stable, although inflated for gamer perspective, you could build a mining farm for Ethereum that made more money out in Ethereum than you spent on electricity, depending on what the electricity costs. I mean, obviously some places that doesn't work, but the upshot is people would build these giant rigs, plug them into warehouses and places, presumably put a giant fan in there so the whole thing doesn't just burst into flames, and they would suck in a whole shitload of power for absolutely nothing and take fake money out the other side. Now, when the value of the Ethereum went down, and also local municipalities and power boards and stuff started cracking down on it, it became more complicated. And the move to proof of stake meant that having a bunch of GPUs was no longer that useful. So all of the miners put their used GPUs on eBay and other aftermarket sites and started dumping them at fire sale prices, which necessarily impacted the cost of the price of new GPUs as well.
Yeah, because I think we should point out, like, I think they refer to it as the merge, right? the move yeah, to the proof of stake.
Ethereum going to proof of stake is called the merge. Yeah, it happened so on Thursday, I think.
Or Wednesday. Right. That's the thing I want to point out. That literally just happened right before this podcast. But this trend has been going on for months now, right? Like it's been several months that 30 series cards are not just widely available, but I'm getting like Newegg sale flyers in my email like weekly for cards like below MSRP.
Yeah. So the merge, we knew the merge was like Ethereum has been talking about going to proof of stake for 2 years at this point, 3 years, like a really long time. And it just never happened. The momentum finally shifted earlier this year. So it did start to move in that direction. And that's around that same time, the crypto crash happened when all the miners got kicked out of China and a bunch of other, the crypto stuff is complicated. Okay. Yeah. The upshot is nobody was buying new GPUs all of a sudden. Also, a huge glut of used GPUs flooded the market that were top, like unlike usual gluts of used GPUs that are last generation boards or whatever, when the new cards come out, this was the current gen shit coming out at low prices. And so it really impacted demand.
Can I jump in?
I was to say, it's worth mentioning that this happened to EVGA in 2019 as well. The last time this happened on the 2000 to 3000, but before the 3000 series boards came out, when the crypto prices dropped again, and it was around that time you couldn't mine Bitcoin with GPUs anymore for all intents and purposes. I think that might've been earlier, but anyway, the upshot is they got stuck with a whole bunch of old GPUs and had to scramble to unload them in 2019. So they've messed this up before.
Yeah. I just want to ask a random question. Would you trust a card that you bought secondhand that had come from a mining farm? Like just because those cards are worked at full load 24/7 for however long?
Nope.
I assume that hastens their oncoming failure.
It can't be good for them.
Yeah.
I mean, I've known people who bought those cards and had no problems. I've known people who bought those cards and had like weird grid shaped distortion on all of their things where there's like one memory chip that's jacked up.
Right.
So
it could run for another 5 years just fine, or it could die in a week.
At the very least, I think I would probably take the coolers off and replace the thermal pads or the thermal interface. So they said it has nothing to do with crypto. I think that's probably not true. If I'm being blunt, like my guess is that they overordered 3000 series GPUs. So okay, the other thing, this is increasingly complicated and kind of more financially than we usually get. NVIDIA took a $1.2 billion write down on old stock with their last quarterly report last month, which means they're saying, hey, we're going to, instead of selling this stock at what we expected to, instead of selling these GPUs at what we expected to, we're going to sell them at a lower price so that we can get rid of them, so we can move it and help the ad and board partners sell their remaining stock. So presumably they're passing those discounts on. My guess is that those discounts to the ad and board partners who had overordered 3000 series cards or GPUs probably came with some caveats along the lines of, hey, if you want to get this write down, this money back from us on the write down, you got to, sell 4000 to commit to selling 4000 series GPUs or something like that. I don't know. That seems like business shit to me. But my guess is that probably the baggage of that, along with the crypto softening and the used market and all that stuff going on, added, like, it just adds more risk to an already risky market. Right. So it also, just to be clear, the last like 3 years for GPU manufacturers been real good if they can make the hardware. And because EVGA owns its own fabs or owns its own assembly lines and all that stuff, they're in a situation where they could presumably make hardware as fast as they can get the components that they need. So they're pulling a Serena Williams here and going out at the top of their game, right? They're not lingering into the waning years of this market.
Yeah. And like, I guess it's probably worth pointing out, like, they are, as of now, my understanding, saying that they're going to basically just keep paying their employees, even though they don't necessarily have a business model to support those roles.
So the speculation there is that they're going to pay the employees that are working the assembly lines by immediately shifting to other kinds of add-in boards. So like there's a massive shortage on computers for cars right now. There's plenty of places that somebody that has a big production line that can turn out millions of boards a year can make money. Okay. I mean, they're like the people that are, whose work is specific to the video card market probably are not in a great place. But it's not like AVGA was writing drivers, right? They had overclocking tools, they had motherboard BIOS and stuff like that, that they were doing. But for the most part, like it wouldn't surprise me to see them doing PSUs and then stuff that we never hear of.
I was just about to say, so this actually could be a stealth B2B pivot.
I mean, entirely possible.
Cause that's happened, you know, like I'm trying to think of like thinking back through my history of building PCs and like some of the brand names that you saw go away. And then like 20 years later, you're shocked to find out like, oh wow, they still exist. Like,
well, like Supermicro just makes workstations now, basically. I mean, I think you can still buy boards, but for all intents and purposes, they're a workstation vendor that also sells hardware.
And server. Yes. So like, yeah. Matrox is one that comes to mind because like in the '90s, Matrox was like the go-to.
I mean, you tell 2D me. Cards. Yeah.
Maybe you disagree, but for 2D, like the Matrox Millennium 2 was like the 2D card to get. And
yeah,
that name is long gone from the PC building space, but they're totally still around making like video walls and stuff.
Well, and they do video capture stuff too. Like right. We had at Whiskey, a Matrox video capture box.
Right.
So yeah, like I would not expect you to be able to buy a whole lot of PC hardware from EVGA, but like their power supplies seem good. I know a lot of people buy their power supplies. They seem to review well. I haven't actually seen one of their motherboards before, I don't think. But yeah, I and then I assume that their mice and keyboards and stuff like that are rebadged other vendors with their own software tacked on. So I don't know for sure. Yeah. It really wouldn't surprise me if the 4000 series boards have some sort of, like, since all the rumors are talking about like SSD slots and stuff like that, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some additional production overhead that they would have had to upgrade their lines to do. And he was just like, hey, this isn't worth us investing in when we have a partner that doesn't seem to really like us very much. The margins are really small. The entire business is super high risk. And like, we're living, like we exist at the whim. What is it they say? I serve and I live to serve in John Wick. Like basically they live at the whims of NVIDIA. So
yes, of course. I should mention here, it's a detail from the Gamers Nexus report that like not only are the margins just as a rule incredibly thin here, as of right now, they are actually losing money on the high end cars that they're selling.
Like, well, I mean, that's because they bought too many of the high end cars because they thought they could gouge the crypto people for them. But yes, that is, I don't doubt that at all.
That they're, I think he said, in the hundreds of dollars on the like 3080 Ti end up.
Yeah.
Level cards.
I mean, and that could be like, for example, if NVIDIA was like, hey, we'll take buybacks on some of these GPUs that you bought. If you agree to do 4000 series cards, that could have been their choice, right?
Okay. So you're speculation.
It's a little bit of a gun to your head, yes, but yeah, like,
sure.
That's business, man.
Yeah. Some of your speculation here maybe makes a little more sense than the way it was presented in this video, which is that just they are dropping their by far their biggest business and replacing it with nothing. But you're kind of suggesting, because they said, hey, we're not going to make boards from Intel or AMD. They did not comment on
that. May or may not. Look, that could be a negotiating tactic too.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. That could change for sure. I mean, 6 months from now, they could very well be down that road. But like you're saying, like they aren't necessarily pivoting to nothing. It's just that maybe they're going to pivot to something that, like you said, we will never hear or care about.
Yeah. Something that makes more money and doesn't, like, every single decision you make isn't a live and die for the company decision.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, big business pivots, paradigm changes happen. I think it's just the fashion in which this has played out in public that is maybe a little eye-opening.
Like, just to be clear, they're calling I obviously have affinity for YouTube. I worked on YouTube for a long time. The running this out through a couple of YouTubers and not bringing in like ours and the you know, the serious, not, I don't want to say serious press, but you know, the people, like, I wonder how many people got pitched the story before these folks said yes, right? Like, you've had those ones shop around before where they're like, hey, we got a scoop for you. And you're like, this is real fishy. I'm not going to.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if I want to get involved in this one. This feels a little weird. Feels a little bit weird.
Yeah.
But again, it's a private company. I hope it doesn't cost a bunch of people their jobs. I know that there's good people doing good work at EVGA. So I hope that they have a plan for this. Yeah. And it could be that, like, this is just a bad business and he didn't want to, like, be the bad guy. He could just be selling the production line stuff. I think he wouldn't say he was going to keep the people on if he was going to sell the production line stuff. Probably. That's my guess. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, they asked him if he was looking to sell the company, and he said no, but that's not quite the same as what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Selling out the stuff that they use to assemble the boards, machines that they use to assemble the boards are really valuable, and like they depreciate a lot, but they're still valuable for other less intensive projects, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about some PlayStation VR real quick?
Yeah, we're already here doing current events stuff. There were a couple of big stories here on the same day. I believe this came out the same day.
I think so, yeah. So they did a PS Direct, right? Or did they just do a blog post?
This is from a podcast.
Okay.
This is from the name, I had it in front of me. It's the podcast that Sid Schumann does.
Oh, okay. The official PlayStation podcast.
Yes.
Yes.
In which they revealed the PlayStation VR 2 will not be able to play PlayStation VR 1 games. It is not backwards compatible, which I was like, okay, look, there are major differences between in hardware capabilities and tracking methods and et cetera, et cetera. I don't know why, but I still kind of assumed this would be addressed at the SDK or API level, that there would be some kind of translation layer there.
I don't think this is a technical choice. I think this is a smart choice. I'm going to give you a hot take, the hottest of hot takes right here.
Hot takes.
I posted this on Twitter already. So if you read my Twitter, I apologize. You're getting a dupe.
Yes.
You think you want PSVR 1 compatibility for your PSVR 2. But I'm going to tell you, it's not going to be good. They're going to spend a lot of time working on it, making it really shitty. And you're going to load it up. You're like, man, these games look like ass and they run real bad. And like 20% of people who put the headset on are going to feel a little bit nauseous.
Well, hang on. When you say run real bad, are you talking internal frame rate, or are you talking like tracking methods? Because those are two different things.
Well, okay. So tracking methods is just a series of data points in space, vectors in space. So like converting tracking methods between different hardware is pretty straightforward, right? Steam VR does it for every, like lighthouses use outside in tracking, or like they use inside out tracking with points of reference that are established by the lighthouses for vibes and indexes. The Windows MR headsets are almost all inside out cameras doing slam on the world around them. The Oculus does the original Oculus has cameras that track the headsets from the outside in. The second gen Oculus uses slam on the outside. It all just works seamlessly together because you're just like, you're literally looking at like three vectors, right?
Right. Right. Well, so the reason I wanted to ask is that the PlayStation VR largely uses optical tracking. It uses a straight up camera that is, I think originally was intended for other purposes than VR, that sits on top of your TV and tracks like literal LED lights on the headset.
And
like
the Move controllers and the gamepad.
What's that?
And the Move controllers and the gamepad.
Yeah. And I think the headset, the VR one headset does have some, what is it? An IMU, like an accelerometer.
They all have IMUs. They have to have IMUs.
Right. Right. Yeah. But again, a lot of that tracking is based on a straight up camera looking at the headset, and it is famously bad. And so the thing I wanted to ask was like, that's a pretty extreme case of mapping an extremely rickety tracking method onto what is much better hardware, but like it still could technically be done, right? Like
you messed up a couple of things here. I'm going to call you out. Sorry, Brad.
Okay. All right.
The IMU is an accelerometer and gyroscope. And the reason you need external tracking along with that, because the early Oculus dev kits just had the accelerometer and gyroscope, right? And a compass. You need the external ones because the gyroscopes and accelerometers tend to drift over time. So you need something that works those work at a high refresh rate. So they're cycling constantly really quickly. And then you use the external tracking to lock them back in place and to counteract the drift, basically. So for the headset, I think the PSVR worked pretty well, assuming you didn't have reflections in the background that popped up multiple lights that confused the camera, right?
I never got that thing to behave itself.
Oh, I used it a bunch, but it was definitely susceptible to interference in the room. Like it was the fiddliest of the first gen shit to set up.
Yeah.
I would say having used it all, definitely a pain in the ass. The big problems with the PSVR were everything had to run on PS4 launch hardware, which is, by the time even PSVR came out, was old, and by today's standards is ancient. And because VR has to run at a higher frame rate than normal console games, so if a normal PS4 game was designed to run at 30 hertz on a 1080p display, that's fine, no problem. In order to get that same hardware to do 60 or 75 hertz on the VR headset, they had to scale everything down so it looked shitty, like a PS2 game in some cases, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, but so what you're talking about now is you're talking about emulating old hardware that ran on an old console on new hardware on a new console. So it's like you're like incepting this. You're like four layers deep here on bad emulation. And my understanding is that the PlayStation emulated stuff doesn't run at higher frame rates on the PS5, right?
Well, it's very situational. It's like games that didn't get updated. Did they have an unlocked frame rate? Then yes, they will run faster by default.
Okay.
For example, they use the same graphics libraries. Like the PS5 is iterative on top of the PS4. It's not there's nothing like wildly different architecturally about it. So like, presumably that's why I'm saying like presumably some compatibility later could have been implemented here. I'm not saying that like Sony was likely to do that.
Well, but okay. So one of the problems, and this is assumption. I haven't talked to anybody who made PSVR games, but this is based on what I know about doing tracking in weird situations. Because the hand tracking, well, first off, the gamepad on the PS5 doesn't have any kind of capacity for tracking the gamepad's position. It has an accelerator and an IMU, but it doesn't have that big light on the front that lets the camera track where it is in space. And right. A lot of the PS4 VR games use that, like the Astrobot game, you shoot the little guys from it and all that. Like
that's fair.
Often a key part of the game.
Right.
So gamepad games are probably not going to work right that require that, which is probably like my assumption is the way you look at this is you start slicing off things that you aren't going to be able to make work ever. And then you start slicing off things that are going to be bad. So when you think about how the hand tracking worked for people who had Move controllers, which they sold a buttload of those in bundles with the headsets, those didn't do, they did X and Y tracking. Okay. So up and down and left and right were okay, but anything forward and back were bad. And my assumption, because of the way I experienced those tracking, is that the people who were writing games like Beat Saber and Pistol Whip and things like that required pretty precise positioning of those controllers did a whole shitload of funky math to interpolate and anticipate where you were going to put those controllers so that they didn't just fly off into space all the time, because that's what happened on all the early PS Move games. So now you're putting that software that has all this weird interpolation shit on it on hardware that precisely tracks the hand position really well in 3D space because it's using inside out cameras and it's state of the art and, you know, only the best, yada, yada. Weird shit's going to happen and it's not going to be good. So you take that, you take the fact that there's probably like seven PSVR games that are being actively played still.
Yeah. Well,
like,
look, okay.
Like Beat Saber and the fit boxing VR and fitness stuff and like things like that are like arcadey or fitnessy, right?
I am fully with you on the technical aspect of this, like being a lot of work, like doing it all programmatically would probably be a giant mess. And like, it would probably require a ton of actual like massaging to make it work acceptably.
Yeah.
From the nobody plays those games standpoint, though, like I would be careful there because like preservation is such a big deal these days that like, well, like a lot of people are going to tell you
one in
like a, well, yeah, I mean, you're right. It's not like that headset is just vanishing from the earth or something, yeah, but like
they're not coming and taking it.
A lot of people will tell you it does not matter how many people are playing a game anymore.
Okay, but I mean,
in terms of whether it should still be playable or not, but it is still playable, though.
Yes,
you're right. You're right. Like those headsets are still around.
I mean, my only point is they're going to do all this work to make this stuff work, and then you're going to put it on. It's going to look like a PS2 game in your fancy new headset, and the tracking is going to be bad.
Selling the PSVR one a little short there. Like, yes, some of those games do look pretty bad close up.
Well, but
just in terms of like texture resolution and stuff like that, you're not wrong. But
like this is a situation where the old headset was relatively low resolution and kind of hid the crimes of the hardware that was running it, right? So when you take that and put it on the new higher res headset with the higher capability hardware, and you're comparing those old games to the new games inside the same headset, those are going to look real bad and the tracking is going to be bad and they're going to be frustrating and not fun. And like that, given how tenuous VR support in the community is often, like you're setting yourself up for failure there. So yeah. especially when doing the upgraded version, like there will be an upgraded version of Beat Saber, I think, even with Oculus owning it now, right? Because that is a game that prints money in terms of DLC downloaded. There's no downside to them continuing to make new versions for all the platforms that it's on. They're like, they've continued to support it on Steam even after the purchase. And I would expect to see an updated PSVR 2 version of that game. And like I said, Pistol Whip and Boxing VR and all the stuff that people play.
That would be the ideal. I think I saw the developers of Moss said that they will they'll update at least book two, if not the first one as well.
Yeah.
So like hopefully that'll happen for, you know, and especially like developers who want to stick with the platform. Like I assume there's utility in porting the old game to the new hardware as a test bed for like learning how it works and being able to make new games but more effectively, right?
Yeah, I mean, if it follows the same kind of, I mean, we don't have actual sales numbers on the Oculus stuff on because Facebook doesn't release that or Meta doesn't release that. But if it follows the same path that the Rift the Rift 2 kind of doesn't count because it was a minimal interest product. But the Rift to the Quest, the Quest 2 did, the potential market size for PSVR 2 games will be enormous compared to the PSVR one. Like they sold, how many PSVR ones did they sell? Like 4 or 5 million of them or something? It was a relatively small number.
Maybe. Well, I mean, I think they touted it as a huge success. I mean, like relative to the PS4 install base, it's a tiny fraction, but I think they seemed very pleased with and it may have been a decent bit more than
maybe 10 million. I can't remember, but
yeah, I don't know if they ever put like sales numbers out, but you remember those bundles started going on pretty deep sales at some point. I think they moved quite a few of those things.
Yeah. 5 million units as of January 2020.
Oh, okay. So, well, that's fairly respectable, I think.
I mean, I think that probably put it in the top three VR headsets sold until top two VR headsets sold until the Quest 2 launched.
Right.
Right. So, you know, and for something that had the problems that it had, it's pretty good. I would say that's pretty good. So the reason the Moss developers are going to support it is because they're assuming, rightly, I think, that they're going to sell a whole shitload of these because they're going to ship it with the hand controllers and they're going to ship it with the camera and it'll be a less fiddly experience. Something I think you just plug in with a USB cable, right? There's not like boxes and power bricks and all the extra shit you had to plug in with the PSVR one.
It is. So yeah, that's actually in a little tangent here. It is a single USB-C cable that plugs right into the front port on the PS5. Like as cabled solutions go, it's as simple as it could be. I'm actually, the thing I was going to say is like, I was excited when I saw that because I've dealt with these breakout boxes and like one of our breakout boxes failed in the office at one point, for example. But like, so I was pretty excited to see like, oh, it's one cable and no box. I'm starting to see a lot of people who seem pretty down on it having a cable at all. And I'm wondering if maybe that seems a little premature to me to just expect this thing to be entirely wireless.
Well, wireless adds a lot more cost, right? So when you get into wireless, like Facebook just raised the price of the Quest 2 a few months ago. As it is now, it can be a relatively stupid device with just minimal hardware on it to drive the screen and to do the slam stuff in the headset. Probably
when you say, I guess you should point out, when you say stupid, you mean like dumb in the sense of a dumb terminal, as in not having extra hardware.
I mean, they don't have to have an expensive ARM CPU in there, SoC in there. The big thing I think is, I mean, it depends. It also kind of depends on the cable. The thing that I liked actually about the PSVR the most is that they did a handful of games that integrated people sitting in the living room. Like they were designed to be played with groups of people sometimes. So like Astrobot is a good example. There were a lot of games in there that if people were sitting around you watching you with the stupid headset on, they could use game pads and like interfere with you or you know, like they could play, people sitting watching the TV could play with you and see what you were doing at the same time. And it was really fun. And I think the cable, like in that situation, the cable is not a real detriment. I don't know. My experience with the cable is generally that after about 3 minutes of using the cable, most people suddenly don't have any problem managing the cable anymore. Is the cable-free world of a Quest a little bit better? Yes. Would I rather pay $400 for a PSVR 2 or $800 for a PSVR 2?
Ooh.
Honestly, that's probably the difference between me buying and not buying a PSVR 2.
God, do you think, is there really that much addition to the cost for something like that?
You're basically putting a cell phone on there.
Yeah, fair.
Right?
Fair.
So you have to have a battery, you have to have an SoC, you have to buy RAM, you have to buy storage, all that stuff.
Jeez, yeah, I guess when you put it that way, yes, sure. I mean, do you think $400 is realistic? Like that's something that every time we talk about this headset, Vinny always asks. When we bring it up, like, what do you think this thing is going to come in at? Because that's obviously a huge deal. And I don't have a great answer for that. I think 400 was where the first one landed.
I think this one's
obviously there's way more to this one.
400 was where the first one landed without controllers. My guess, like here's the thing. I think if they sell this without controllers, they've made a mistake.
I don't think they are. I'm pretty sure there's only one bundle or one SKU there.
So like that's a good choice. The other thing about not using a wireless thing, the experience that they provide to customers is entirely dependent on which Wi-Fi standard their router supports and where it is. So, hey, if you don't want returns on a PlayStation VR headset, then you sell it to somebody with an 802.11n router. Like this thing sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you sell them to somebody with an AX router and it's in the other side of their house. It's still going to suck. So Anyway, my guess is $500, but I don't know. My guess is they'll price it the same as the Quest, regardless of what the Quest costs. The difference is they'll probably chuck a game or two in with it. Like it wouldn't surprise me if they do an updated version of like London Heist and the Astrobot or a new Astrobot plus the old one.
And Astro's Playroom was such a resounding success as a pack-in with the PS5. Like to just replicate that with this headset would be pretty smart. So I mean, that is the true value of a new PlayStation VR to me. It's not the technical aspect. It is, well, there are two things actually. It's the comfort is one. Like I haven't worn every newer headset on the market, but at least in the PSVR 1 era, it was by far the most comfortable.
The Halo was really comfy, yeah.
Yeah, and easiest to put on and take off headset out there. But the other thing, the bigger thing is that Sony just supports it on the development side pretty strongly, right? Like, Sony knows how to make good video games, and they did that. They supported developers to make a lot of unique software.
Well, they put first party developers on them, which is like in addition to paying a bunch of third party stuff to come out.
Right.
The other thing that's interesting to me about it is they have an IR tracking, so they can theoretically do some foveated rendering in it, which means that when you have eye tracking, I don't know if you realize it. People probably your brain kind of filters it out, but like the density of your vision, the visual acuity is strongest in a relatively small area in the center of your field of vision wherever you're looking, and so, you can kind of blur out the areas that are outside that and do lower fidelity on the outer edges, which means that then they can apply even more horsepower to the part that you can see really well because they know what you're looking at inside the headset. And I think they're going to be the first ones that ship that in a way that it'll be usable by average developers.
Oh, is that not in Quest 2?
Quest 2 doesn't have eye tracking.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I feel like there are some headsets that have eye tracking. Like there's a Vive Pro that has eye tracking. There's a handful of others, but you have to do some work on the development side to support them. And because those headsets are relatively low volume, nobody bothers. So, or very few people bother. So the fact that Sony is doing it and presumably it'll be part of the AP, part of the SDKs, and it'll just work is pretty exciting, I think. So,
yeah. Well, especially on a fixed platform, that's just going to be less powerful over time relative to what else is out there, right?
Well, I mean, and that is the other thing. Like the PSVR 1 was announced and finalized at a time when like there was still a massive amount of development going on what VR hardware looks like, and like they made some really good decisions in terms of like the Halo and the way the screen kind of slides in and out in front of you and is comfortable to put on and off. They've messed up things like the headphones, right? Like having to put on headphones over top of that thing was uncomfortable. The earbuds are annoying. They messed up on things like the box, which was a kind of unavoidable side effect of the age of the console that was out when it launched. And then the controllers were definitely bad. So it's much more stable now. Like the headsets, like we're not seeing massive increases in resolution and massive increases in capability. Like eye tracking is one of the last things that needs to go in. So they're positioned to be pretty well placed going forward. What's the headphone situation like on this new one? Have they said?
I don't remember. They've put out pretty much the entire info dump. They actually, in fact, like people have played this thing at TGS as of this past week or the week before.
General public they had playing?
Yes. Well, maybe not. Maybe not. I'm not sure if the general public had access or if it was just a behind closed doors, but it was open enough that everyone has written about it. Like you can find hands-on reports from like The Verge and stuff out there about it now. I don't remember the headphone situation. Are they integrated? Probably. Maybe. Isn't that what everybody does now?
I'd be surprised if they don't.
No, it still has a stereo headphone jack.
I mean, I guess that's nice so you can add your own headphones, but
I believe that was the second model, the revision of the PSVR one. That was the feature, right? That they included earbuds, or like there's a little earbud holders on the side if you want to use. I think they maybe give you dinky little earbuds, but you can use.
Mine came with short cable headphones, earbuds, but it didn't have a way to attach them to the headset. Okay. There's also rumble in the headset, which is interesting.
Yeah. Excuse me. Excuse you, haptics.
Sorry, haptics. Sick haptics. So yeah, I don't know. Like I didn't hate the PSVR one. I found it. I don't think it had a microphone either, which was a shortcoming. I'm very interested in the PSVR too. I think they've done something pretty compelling, and they increased the panel refresh rate, which will make less people barf, which is good. So
again, I'm very bullish on it for basically the reasons I mentioned earlier, that like Sony is uniquely positioned to put development resources against this thing. Especially now that the hardware is truly competitive.
And there's a kind of a lot of existing software out that can just switch over, that like people can port over relatively easy to the new hardware. Cause like honestly getting the movement stuff to work. I looked at that and was like, oh God, this is going to be a nightmare to figure out how to adjust for the bad tracking on the Move controllers.
Yeah. The other thing that is exciting to me about it is that it's just a turnkey solution. Like it's the kind of the strength of the consoles have always had, right? Like, especially now that there's no box, you just plug it into your thing and it works. Like, granted, let's say that Windows Mixed Reality is maybe not the most robust platform these days.
It works the same way. And I've found that those headsets are very reliable.
Well, the hardware, even though it's an older headset, like the headset's always been fine. It's more like at the software level, like the Mixed Reality hub has broken numerous times as they've updated it on me. Yeah. And like, I would have to like wipe everything and go in and redo all of the positioning setup again, because they pushed out another version that seemed to break everything, or it couldn't find the headset again. You know what I mean? Like,
that happens on all of the headsets except for the Vive.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah. Well, I don't have an Oculus. Oculus? Really? You think they would have figured that out by now?
My Quest has to, like, the Quest. So the Slam stuff, because of the way the Slam stuff works, it looks like it does like stereo video of your room and then figures out what the 3D space is like from that. If you like move your chair 2 inches, it fucks up the calibration and you have to redo the whole thing. So,
to be clear, I'm not just talking about it not doing the tracking well. I'm talking about like plugging the headset into the USB and HDMI and having the hub not see the headset.
That's a different problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it used to be that the dog would walk through the play area while I was using the Quest, and it would be like, hey, you're out of your chaperone area. You need to redo, you need to recalibrate this thing or you're going to die. And then you just hit the ignore button. So this is our scene drama. People were really upset about this on Twitter yesterday, and I thought it was pretty stupid. So
which part? The VR?
The PSVR thing.
Again, I think that comes from a preservationist's mindset of wanting to just have access to as many games as possible at all times.
Yeah, but Chew's not going to come into your house and take away your old PSVR just because you didn't buy a PSVR 2. Probably.
Probably. I don't know.
Probably. Brad, we've reached... Oh.
I was gonna say I don't know what he gets up to. I mean, but he's off the clock. Maybe he's out there.
I mean, maybe Greg Rice will come. He's very tall. He could take your stuff away.
It's true.
Brad, we've reached the point of the show where we thank our patrons.
We have. Thank you, patrons.
Thank you, patrons. As always, if you would like to learn how you can support Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod, you can go to patreon.com/techpod. That's patreon.com/techpod. We're the only one there. The only tech pod on Patreon.
That's right.
And for as little as $2 a month, you can chuck a little bit of cash our way so we can keep doing the show.
Mm-hmm.
If you would, and in addition to thanking our associate producer patrons once a month at the end of the month, which would be, I think, next week or the week after, we also like to thank our executive producer patrons every month, including Paddle Creek Games, makers of Fractured Veil, Andrew Slosky, Bunny Crimes Doesn't Think Code Injection Is a Feature. Seems very specific, but I don't know. Wedge, Joel Krauska, and Twinkle Twinkie, and James Kamek. Thank you all so much. We appreciate you.
Yes, we do.
And we will see you all next week.